Meet Sven.
Yeah.
He's very excited right now. Sven doesn't play poker, but he's still very excited. You see, Sven is a dealer for Porsche, and he's just found out that PokerStars players earn $7.5 million in VIP points every month. And with our all-inclusive program, that's enough to redeem 5 of the lovely pieces of German engineering every day.
Yeah!
Keep Sven happy. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP to find out why our rewards program seems to leave other schemes, well, out of commission. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Annie Up PokerCast presented by PokerStars. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's May 28th, 2010, and this is the best PokerCast on the internet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Scott, I think it's safe to say that you and I are frugal.
Yes. You have the F-R-U-G, but yes, I'm definitely right there with the A-L.
You put the Al in frugal.
Yes.
So, you know, it occurred to me recently that you and I were going to have a decision to make. You know, when we take our cruise all over the world, and by all over the world, I mean Cozumel, Mexico.
This is international.
Hey, it's all over the world. But one of the biggest complaints we always get on our cruise is our cash game chips are just too slippery.
They're a little slick.
People pick them up out of the rack, and of course, inevitably, their middle finger and their thumb would squeeze together. The middle chips would go all over the place, or they'd try to stack it on the table, and the ship would hit like an iceberg, and the chips would slide into other people's stacks, and they wouldn't know whose chips were whose, and they'd complain and bitch. And so I went in search of a solution.
Tournament chips are completely different now. Tournament chips are awesome.
Tournament chips are awesome. So we thought, okay, well, maybe for the next cruise, we'll buy cash game chips, just like the tournament chips, because they're so nice, people like them and everything. So we're like, all right, well, what's the price, you know? And they came back with a good price, but it was a little steep for the frugality that is Annie Up.
Well, considering that the cash game chips have been used twice.
Yes, and are already paid for,
yes.
Right? And I'm like, we already have chips, now we got to buy more chips because people don't like these chips? There's got to be a solution. Calgon, take me away. So, you know, I went in search of a solution. And let me tell you, just as a front, it was like asking a bunch of grandmothers for a remedy to the common cold. It's like, oh, you need to sweat out that fever, or you need to feed that cold, or drink the blood of a wild boar when the moon is full, you know?
Hey, that works.
I know it works, but it only works when you have a fever and a stomach ache. That's the problem. But really, people were like, talc. Talc or baby powder. That will work. Now, of course, that seems counterintuitive to me. I mean, put something slippery and slick on something that's slippery and slick. This isn't algebra when you put two negatives together to get a positive. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, we did have a number of MacGruber's on our cruises that, you know.
MacGruber's. So I tried them both, and of course, both made it worse. They were more slippery. So that didn't work. So now I'm like, all right.
But the good news is that we'll add an ice rink to the next Annie Up Poker Cruise.
You could do, like, curling with these chips. They slide so well.
Triple sow cows.
So then I said, I remember when I used to bowl back in the days of yore, I used to have a rosin bag that would absorb moisture on your hand. And it was rosin. It's like ground up cement or rock or whatever the hell it is.
Yeah, I never knew what that thing was, but everybody else looked cool, you know, picking it up and slapping it in their hands while they're waiting for the ball to come back. So I did it. So.
Yeah, you know, you see pitchers do it too in baseball. It absorbs the moisture from your hand and makes you be able to grip better. So I thought, grip.
Oh, really?
Hey, okay. There you go, grip, right? So I took a stack of 20 of them and I cut up on my old rosin bag for my bowling ball, you know, and put the chips in there.
The sacrifices you make for Annie Up.
Yeah, I mean, now I don't have a rosin bag. If I ever decide to go back to bowling again, I have to buy another one. But anyway, so I start shaking up the chips. I take them out. Sure enough, it actually works. The chips were, like, not slippery as much anymore, and they kind of stack nice and everything. But the problem is, you know, the rosin will wear off. It will go away, and the chips are still unaffected, and they'll still be slippery. So I'm like, well, this isn't going to work. Plus, can you imagine a player's getting the chips with remnants of talc and rosin on their chips on the ship? People will be freaking out. Is this anthrax? Oh, my God. We'd have the ship in irons. People will be jumping overboard, you know? It's like, all right, we can't use talc powder. We can't use baby powder. We can't use rosin because I just don't want the headaches. So someone said acetone. Now, I thought, you know, acetone takes
the... Wow, isn't that like suntan lotion?
No, it's like the stuff that takes the nail polish off women's nails.
Oh, sounds like it should be suntan lotion.
Which, that's really funny. so anyway, I was afraid to use that, though, because there is like acid in there, and there are like these sticker adhesives on these chips. And I was afraid the liquid would get in there and pull the stickers off, and... And plus, I didn't want to kill myself breathing in all these fumes and burning my hands with acetone and everything. So,
and we'll pause this absolutely hilarious story to remind our listeners how much of his 24 hours every day that Chris spends worrying.
That's all I ever do.
It's also the TSA has had the Chris worry level at solid red.
But I still got through with my toothpaste, no matter how much I worried. All right, so that was out of the question. So finally I found a site online, because I looked up slippery chips and everything, and someone said they used a fine grit sandpaper, and then it worked for them.
All right.
So I went to my toolbox, took out a piece of fine grit, started sanding the chips, and lo and behold, it worked. And it didn't affect the sticker, you know, in the middle. It didn't pull it off. It didn't really ruin it or anything. But it made the outside plastic slash composite slash piece of crap chip scuffed up nice enough that it wasn't slippery. So I'm like, all right. But just in case, I took a page out of Mythbusters and I did a control test. Right? I took one stack of 20 that were talced, one stack of 20 that were rosined, and one stack of 20 that I sanded, and I placed them on like this plywood. And I put them all right in a row so that they would start at the same spot. And then I lifted the board, tilted it slowly upward, and watched the chips as they slid off. And see how long it would take one to slide off and then the other stack and all that. And sure enough, the talc like slid chips into Sarasota County, so that didn't work. The rosin chips were okay, but they still slipped further, and the sanded chips were best. They barely slid at all. The whole stack stayed together for a while, and then when they finally did, they didn't go as far as the others. So I'm like, all right, that's it. That's the method we have to use, you know? So now, now they had the answer, and I knew how to fix them. There's one problem. It took me almost 15 minutes to sand one stack. That's about 40 seconds a chip. Plus, I actually sanded some of the skin off my fingertips. You know, because you're doing it by hand.
Right.
And that's not good, right? I mean, if I did 20 of them, I was already bleeding from 20. Imagine, we have 10,000 chips.
Well, you know, here's the thing. We're a cubicle dweller, so, I mean, it's not going to kill you to have that weathered look, you know.
Yeah.
Give some street cred when you're out there.
But, you know, the thing is, that works out, if I did it by hand, about 1,111 hours of sanding.
Yeah, just in time for any of Cruise 3, probably.
Well, needless to say, I need a much
You'd
more efficient
like
way.
You'd be running like Jack and jumping on the ship. You know, all the ship!
I have the chips in a sack over my shoulder running up to the boat. So I need an efficient way to make it feasible, you know, to try to save this money and save the man hours and everything. So the first thing that came to mind was a belt or circular sander, you know. And my stepson, Charles, he works in the business like that. He has tools like that, and he builds things. And so I was like, hey, man, come on over with one of the circular sanders, and let me pick your brain about how I should do this all at once. So he suggests, hey, let's just lay them all out on the ground and go over it with the sander, because the sander's not very powerful. It just spins a little bit. And it might just – so I'm like, I don't think that's going to work, man. It's going to shoot them all over the place.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't do that near the flat screen TV.
Yeah, yeah. So we did it in the garage, you know. And sure enough, pew, pew. They're shooting all over like, you know, like those Western movies when they dump the ammunition into the fire and the guns going all off and everything, you know. Oh, I'm like, holy cow, these chips are going everywhere. So – now we realized we needed to have the chips be stable. So I'm like, what if we took the chips and put them in like a tube that were stacked, you know, inside the tube, and then just fed them toward the sander, you know? So he's like, well, I like that idea. So we're like, all right, let's go to Home Depot in search of PVC pipe, right? I get there. I find a 10-foot PVC pipe that fits the chips perfectly. I mean, there's no room at all for error, yet they won't get hung up in them. It's like they were meant for this. I'm actually thinking of carrying these chips on the ship this way because the pipe holds them nice and neat. It's amazing. So, of course, I don't need 10 feet of pipe here. You know what I mean? I need, like, 5. So I'm like, all right, we need to cut this in half. I don't have the right saw at home. Charles is like, oh, no, you can cut it here. You know, people take their trim to where they need it in the store, and they just cut it with the saw.
Yeah, you take it to a little guy, and you push the little button, and you wait an hour for him to show up to cut your stuff.
Yeah, so I go over there, and, of course, there's no guy there. There's a little old lady cutting, like, corner trim by herself.
Yeah.
So I'm like, move over, lady. I'm cutting this pipe. Now, this is a lawsuit waiting to happen.
Absolutely.
The teeth on this saw was like a barracuda. It was all jagged and all – I mean, it was ridiculous. So I cut the pipe, you know, and it works out. It works nice and clean. Cut it. Go up to the front, do the self-checkout thing, get, you know. But first I had to get, like, sandpaper discs for the sander because I'm not going to use Charles's, you know, company's products. So I go there, and it takes those self-adhesive ones. It doesn't take the kind where you clip them on or anything.
Okay.
So I look for them, and, like, there's, like, no circular self-adhesive sandpaper discs in the whole store that were of the grit that I needed. It was either too fine or too rough.
Yeah, see, that's the reason I don't go to Home Depot, man. You can't go to these little boutique home improvement stores and find stuff. You got to go to the big ones, man, where they have everything. You know, I'm not trying to put the little guy out of business, but
I know,
I don't think,
like,
Home Depot is going to be able to survive.
It should be the Taj Mahal Depot instead. That's the one I need to go to. So finally, she's like, well, the lady that was there was helping us. She's like, well, here's the grit you need. It's self-adhesive, but they're square. So, of course, I was determined to prove that you can put a square peg in a round hole.
I figured that as soon as I heard that, I knew where you were going with that.
Well, it's true. It's true, though. You can do it because you put the square ones on, and it just the adhesive holds them, and they just spin. It makes no difference. So, I haven't used them yet because the original one on there is so good. But
Wendy's hamburger on a McDonald's bun.
Exactly. It's exactly that. So we get home, right, and now I got to configure a way to put these chips in the pipe to the sander. So at first I was like, all right, let's put a pole into the pipe on one end behind the chips, right? And then stand it up and hold the sander on top of the pipe and then just press down. And when the chip is done, push down and move over, push down and move over. But that wouldn't work because the chips would go flying all over the place. They wouldn't fall into anything, right? They go, oh, that's crazy. So then we had to come up with a way to secure the pipe horizontally so that if you push from one side, the chips would feed into the sander. And if one of us would be holding the sander, the other one would be pushing the pipe, and then they'd have to fall down in some sort of container. So I took some painter's tape, right? You know, that blue stuff that they're always putting on TV saying, oh, look how nicely I made these lines. And I take the painter's tape, and I secure the PVC horizontally on the shelf of my tool chest with the ends hanging off. And then below the sander, I put a clothes hamper, right, to catch all the chips on one end. And then Charles is sitting in the seat on the other, feeding the chips through the pipe. And on the left of it, I had a card table stacked sideways to prevent, like, chips that ricocheted off and didn't go straight down. Because, you know, you got a circular sander here. These things start going round and round and firing all off and everything. Yeah. So I got a table over there deflecting them from hitting my car and going down into the pan or into the whole clothes hamper. And then on the right of the clothes hamper, I got one of those big pasta pans to make sure if they go to the right, they don't, you know. So, it looks like something out of, you know, redneck, you know, monthly, quarterly, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, I had this contraption made. It was hilarious.
The plot for Back to the Future 4. You have a flex capacitor on that thing?
Oh, my God. So, all right. So, now, here's the funny part is, our frugality with obtaining these chips is why...
I think at this point, it's all your frugality at this point.
But listen, the reason that we're in this situation is because we didn't want to spring for, like, you know, the most expensive chips possible because we couldn't afford them at the time. Right. And that's why we're in this situation. But at the same time, it saves my ass because one side has our logo. The other side has the company's logo that made the chips for us or distributed them or whatever. So if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have known what side of what chip I sanded first when I wanted to go through the second time around. So I was like, all right, so this is cool, so this helps me. So now we stack the tube with the Anti-Up logo facing out first, and then, you know, we do a whole tube full or a whole tray full or whatever, and then we turn them over, and we know what to turn them over to because, you know, because we were cheap and bought half our side and half someone else's side on stack, and it actually helped me out, which is pretty funny. All right, so all told, we spent about 3 hours between going to Home Depot, configuring this contraption, and sanding and stacking. Guess how many we did in that span of time?
Five.
Five. Look, come on, I did 15 in 20 minutes by hand, or did 20 in 15 minutes.
You're trying to tell the story while you're sanding, you know. Seem pretty excited about it, and so maybe you got distracted.
Oh, no, all right.
All right, how about 45?
Okay, we did 3,100. That's more than 1,000 an hour. And, of course, that was just one side. We only did one side. We did 3,100 chips one side. So don't forget, it's also driving to Home Depot, figuring out how to do this, getting it all ready and everything. So I think I anticipate doing the other side of 3,100 in about 2 hours. So now, you know, a few hours, you know, out of my life, but I saved us like a couple of grand for like $7 of PVC pipe and sandpaper.
Yes, and the best part, too, is the residuals we get from YouTube for putting this thing on the air would be amazing.
I really should video it. I thought about videoing it, or at least taking photos. I thought about taking photos and, like, uploading them, because I still have the contraption in the garage because, you know, I couldn't do them all in one day, and I didn't want to take it all apart and then put it all back together again. So it's like sitting there waiting to be used again. But it works. You put the chips together, you pick them up, and you put the two roughed up edges next to each other, and the chips are beautiful. It's like clay chips. And then you put the two slippery sides together, and they slip apart, so you know it's working. And they're not damaged or anything. They're chips. No one will ever have any idea, especially when you're playing with them in a game or whatever. So I'm pretty happy. But that was my adventure with chips this week, and I thought you'd be proud of that.
Wow. Proud is an interesting adjective. appreciative, maybe.
I think both. I'll take appreciative, since I saved the company a bunch of money. I'll take that. But it leads right into our next item. That was all just a segue to talk about our cruise.
That was our longest segue ever to announce Antia Poker Cruise 3, the tray.
The tray.
And we'll continue the tease here. We're not actually ready to announce it yet, but we're very, very close.
Yes.
All right, the next show, we should definitely have all the details. But if you're looking to block out some time, I would probably block out 4 nights starting October 25th. Just a guess. If you're looking to book an airfare, I would look to fly into Orlando and take the transfer over to Port Canaveral. Just a guess. And if you're looking to budget some money, I would budget somewhere in the neighborhood of a lot less than what we've charged on our past.
How many dollars and a lot less?
Considerable.
Oh my God!
I think when we're all done, people are going to be very excited about the price point, as they would say on The Apprentice, for the next cruise. And hopefully next week we'll get that all going. But yeah, we're definitely looking to get Antia Poker Cruise 3 up and running, and it should be our best one yet.
Absolutely, I'm looking forward to using the chips.
Sanded sticky chips.
And, you know, if the chips somehow people still complain about them, then maybe we'll continue to look for cheaper chips. But
I'll figure out my own contraption. since I don't even know the difference between a Phillips and a regular head screwdriver. So you can only imagine what my contraption is going to look like with the tools that I have in my garage. But, you know.
Yeah, when we first started the business, I went over to your house and found out that you, hadn't even really put your desk all the way together yet. And when I got there and saw the way you had assembled it, I thought, yeah, I'm going to be the one doing all the mechanical stuff for this company.
Oh, man. All right. Well, look forward to the cruise details on the next podcast, hopefully. We'll be sending out an email to it, too. And hope to see a lot more of the podcast listeners on it this time. Mm. We're getting closer to the podcast listener price level, I believe.
I think so. I mean, it's going to be hard to...
We won't get it to free, which is really, I think, the predominant price point level for the podcast listenership.
Yeah, it's close, though.
As low as we can possibly get it and have any hope of getting a couple of the podcast listeners to spring some money on Antia.
Well, of course, speaking of our podcast listeners, one of their favorite things to do is play in our Ape series. Our next event is May 29th at noon, and it is Raz.
It is Raz, and what an interesting little Raz tournament this is going to be. You know, last Saturday we had our free roll. You know, the very generous folks at Poker Stars that give away 10 seats, $55 for nothing, other than to make our listeners happy that Poker Stars is giving. Occasionally things go wrong. And, you know, it just warms my heart how appreciative our listeners are of this free gift and how little they complain when things go wrong. I'll pause for the facetiousness of my comment there. Because the free roll on Saturday was supposed to be Raz, turned out to be Stud. I'm sorry.
You know, it's not that big of a difference. It's either the worst hand wins or the best hand wins.
It really is.
What's the problem? You're playing Stud still. Raz is Stud. What's the big deal?
Yeah, it wasn't really that big a deal. I mean, we wish it was Raz, yes. But when you signed in with your password, it clearly said Limit Stud. All right, so that's when the little Vince Van Patten bells go off that, maybe this isn't going to be Raz. And then just to be safe, when I got to my table, I'm like, folks, it looks like we're playing Stud today. Just beware. And, of course, the first hand went crazy at my table. Kings and Jacks raising all the way in with a bunch of low cards. It turns out that I think everybody actually knew what was going on. The lows were going for a flush or straight or something. But it was Stud, no big deal. So, and I really was appreciative of the free roll, even though it was Stud instead of Raz, because I was doing our community garage sale.
Right.
That I was out in my hot, sticky garage doing whatever I can to get people to take my crap away from me and leave some crumbs of currency in their wake. And the fact that I could play the free roll out in the garage and have a good time with our listeners, oh, boy, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. And then one of our listeners, Brett, you know, with the steel-toed underwear.
Yeah, yeah.
He was having a garage sale, too, out in Nebraska, too, so we were swapping stories. It was actually kind of funny. But I actually, Chris, cashed.
Yes!
I cashed in the free roll.
That is a cash.
Won my seat. Was very excited. Had to suck out close to the bubble to get in. And my excitement, though, was tempered 2 days later when I looked at my calendar and realized I'm going to be in New York City on Saturday for the event. It's plausible that I could actually fire up my computer and play, but it ain't going to happen. And then for a couple days to meet some friends, I got a new baby, and you know, I can't say, hey, thanks, I'm welcome here, where am I staying? All right, that's in my bed, great, thanks. I'll see you in 3 hours.
No, it's Raz. You'll see him in like 15 hours. Yeah.
So, unfortunately, I'm going to be one of these interloper-esque people that the listeners will whine about because my stack will be dead on Saturday, and I deeply, deeply apologize for the fact that I will very likely cash despite that because the rest of the Anti-Up Nation is going to be at Frank's house for a home game.
That's like Frank's favorite game, too.
Excited. He's been working all these Saturdays, Chris, you know. He's at the hospital saving lives. He's at the meta spa making lives better. And never has time for a home game anymore. He has Saturday off. Oh, we're going to have a home game. And, of course, everybody's like, oh, we'll be there. And then I'm like, hey, guys, it's apes. So I think the over-under is probably going to be 15 players in apes.
Which 10 have seats.
So, and in fact, of its limit, I think my dead stack probably has a good shot of cashing.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious.
What a pinnacle of my poker resume to cash in a tournament that I'd even play in.
Yeah, you know, and it's on a Saturday, so we thought, you know, oh, we'll get the European nation involved. But hey, it's not like it's Omaha, so you're probably right. You're probably going to get like 15 people playing this thing.
Well, yeah, so it could be listen to up the folks of you that listen to the show early before Saturday. Good chance of winning a banana there.
Yeah, you got to play your odds.
Edward. Yeah, you got to get past Edward M. 111111 though, who wanted to see it in the free roll too, and seems to be unstoppable.
That's right. You said win a banana, but actually, you want to win an Eddie.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And you know, I was a little shocked actually that Eddie didn't win American Idol this week. Seems to be winning everything else, but good luck for that, guys. And then our next free roll will be sometime soon. I believe it's going to be... Actually, I don't know what it's going to be.
You're burning a hole in my ear there, buddy.
Sorry. I was seeing if I could quickly figure it out since I didn't take the time to actually write it in the notes. But go to anyamagazine.com/apes. You'll find out what the next free roll is. I'm sure it's some kind of no limit variation because we alternate the games. and then hopefully we'll all be back playing the actual event here coming up pretty soon.
You know, you brought up the home game. And yes. Our next item to talk about today involves the Antiope home game, sort of, right?
Yeah, you know, I was at the garage sale, and this was Operation Get Rid of Crap. That's what the wife and I called it. We weren't being greedy with the prices. You know, I let guys talk me down to a dime for playing cards.
Wow.
Seriously, dude, all you got's a dime. Turns out the one lady that talked me down didn't even have a dime. She had to send her husband running all the way down the driveway to get a dime. So, you know, I was trying to get rid of product, moving product.
Right.
And so, you know, I've had the, you know, remember the original Antiope home game table, Chris, that we had? It was a long family heirloom. My grandmother played on it decades ago. It had that green felt that kept ripping off.
Yeah, you know, I think when I started playing in your home game, though, it was blue. I think we're using the same table. I don't think I ever played on your old table.
Oh, well, you never played on the original one.
I don't think I did.
Where we started, back before you started the game then, it is this octagon table with folding legs, little rickety folding legs. But it's got nice little chip holders there for your chips and stuff. But the felt, you know, it's seen better days, right?
Yeah.
The felt coming off. And so the intrinsic value to me has not allowed me to throw this thing away. And so finally, you know, like, it's Operation Get Rid of Crap. So I put it out in the garage sale, and I'm like, you know, maybe someone will just take it, and then I can't complain that I got some money out of it, and I'll watch the Long Family Heirloom go on to another happy house. It did not sell, Chris.
Oh.
Apparently no Antiope fans came to the Harbor Woods Village community garage sale. And so I was lamenting this on the during the free roll, and a couple of folks said, you know what, Scott? Yeah, there might be some fans that might buy that from you. And that's when it clicked, you know what? Maybe there are some fans out there that would want a piece of Antiope history. So here's what we're going to do. I got to work out the details, Chris, but hopefully by next week, we are going to start a Antiope home game table auction where folks can bid on this table. You'll sign it. I'll sign it. We'll see if we can get Fastwood to sign it, some other Antiope luminaries to sign it. So it will be an autographed piece of Antiope history. And you may not want to play on it because it's so riggedy, but the legs fold up. You can actually even put it on your wall, you know, if you don't mind divorcing the wife. We got a couple other stuff that I salvaged from the garage sale, quote unquote, did not sell. And, you know, we'll put our John Hancocks on it, and we'll see if we can sell it. And we're doing this all, Chris, for charity.
Yes.
This will not go into our Buy New Chips for the Poker Cruise Fund. we will look for some worthy causes, and whatever money we make from getting rid of our Antiope history, we will give to folks in need. How's that?
Sounds good. Sounds good. You know, that's the thing, too. You know, some people buy stuff that they don't necessarily need, but they know it's going to a good cause and a charity, and, you know, they'll have a little history of Antiope and our autographs and stuff, and who knows, maybe we'll be rich and famous someday, and then the table in turn will be worth something, too. So, hey, charity is for charity, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I like it. All right, so stay tuned next week. We'll hopefully have more details on that. And, Chris, I always like when we get letters from folks that like us. call it the Sally Field phenomenon. They're much nicer than the hate mail that we get. And this week, Roy wrote us, and real quick, you know, just warmed my heart. He wrote to say, it's not often I write a website or podcast, but I got to say I recently found your podcast, and that's all I listened to on a recent trip south, 8 hours each way.
Wow.
The fact that people drive 8 hours, I still don't get that now.
Wow, 16 hours of us? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Crazy. But he says, great show, great topics, not the typical, quote, poker talk I hear all the time. Well, thank you. You know, you're telling me that Joe Seabock doesn't talk about sanding chips in his garage? I'm shocked to hear that. He goes on to say, I really enjoyed finding and looking forward to checking out the weekly shows moving forward. Well, Roy, thank you. You made our week.
Well, clearly Roy has not played in our Apes Free Rolls yet and been annoyed by it.
doesn't know that he's supposed to hate us.
He's an untainted fan at this point. Well, Roy, thanks for the letter, man. That was really cool, and I'm glad that we can make a trip better. That's one of our favorite things is hearing about, you know, all the guys who commute and the trains and their long hour drives to work and stuff listening to the show. So I'm glad we could do it for you, and hopefully you'll keep on listening. Hey, Scott, we have a plethora of items for the Annie Up News. There's so many that we had to hold a few this week.
Actually, I had to hold them. I didn't have to go digging for crap to put on the news desk this week.
It's pretty awesome. So let's get right to it.
All right. The 2010 World Series of Poker kicks off this week, and for the first time, event winners will earn personalized bracelets, Chris.
Wow.
On Tilt Designs has been hired by Harris to create a World Series of Poker lifestyle collection, and in turn has hired famed poker designer Steve Soffa to create the bracelets.
Okay, Steve, that's COS as in Sam, EN as in Nancy, ZA. Cosenza. Remember that for the Raz bracelet.
Yeah, so they're actually going to engrave them right there in front of you, you know, when you get all your money and stuff.
That's
and then
cool.
Then they're going to allow even, I believe, additional personalization if you're willing to spend some of that hard-earned money that you just won to make it one of a kind.
Chris, a.k.a. Will Hopper. Although maybe people call me the Sandman now. I don't know.
I'm calling myself Free Roll.
Free Roll. All right. The MGM Mirage has opened the Ivy Room, a one-table, high-limit area for Phil Ivy, at its newest property, the Aria at Cine Center. One of MGM Mirage's top executives is Bobby Baldwin, of course, whom the Bellagio's Bobby's Room is named after. Usually you make a little comment here, but I wanted to say, anyway, it picks up our latest issue now. We have a funny story in there about Bobby Baldwin,
yes.
Written by our good friend Dan Malka. So just pick that up for our June issue.
Yes, very good. And I love how they called this the one-table high-limit room.
I know.
You know, I'm not sure one table qualifies as a room, no matter who you have in there. But,
well, it says high-limit area, so I guess that...
No,
that could...
I changed that.
Oh, you changed it, okay.
They called it a room. I refuse to play that game.
That's funny.
You're going to have two tables to make a room at Nanny Up. But that's great. Ivy's got his own room now. So.
Yeah, pretty wild.
Rich get richer, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, finally, Team China, featuring Johnny Chan and Xiao Zhang, was the winner of the $300,000 first prize in the World Team Poker event this month at the Golden Nugget. The event featured six-player teams representing eight countries in the multi-game format that funneled down to a final table.
Wow. Well, those are two of the best players in the world, so it makes sense. I actually didn't get any I didn't follow that at all. Did you follow any of that?
I didn't really, actually. It seemed like a good concept. I think they had, like, you know, limit hold'em in there, no limit, pot limit Omaha.
Right.
So, you know, it's kind of an event that's more to our liking, I think, kind of a mixed game kind of thing. And it sounds like Team USA, who I don't know who really was on it, but they flamed out pretty quickly.
Okay, it's time for our hotline. Call 813-448-1120. And if we use your clip, we'll give you something cool. This clip comes from, hey, someone named Chris, who says last week's burn clip, we could have explored a different angle.
Oh, I like that.
Let's see what he
nice
says.
Nice segue.
Thank you.
The caller described a situation where there was a question as to whether or not there was a burn in the hand. While I think you guys came to the correct procedural decision, I think in this case the decision might go the other way, and here's why. The dealer asks, did I burn a card, giving everyone at the table the opportunity to say yes or no. And everyone says, yes, there was a burned card. At this point now, the other guy who's in the hand is free-rolling if you let him angle shoot this way. And that's what it could have been. Maybe not. Maybe it was just innocent. But what he gets to do is see the card. Oh, that hit the flush or that hit the straight. I want another shot at it. So now he pipes up and says, well, the card wasn't burned. So you see, you give him two bites at the apple in this case.
Now, I agree with this in a way, but again, ultimately, you still have to get it right. I agree with him that if the guy was savvy enough to realize that there wasn't a burn and could say there was a burn and let him do it and then see if he hit his hand or not, and yeah, I agree. But, I mean, so many things had to come into play there for it to actually come out to be an angle shoot. You have to be totally prepared for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're going to have to set that up somehow.
Yeah.
You know that the dealer is capable of, or you've just played enough that you, hey, ooh, didn't burn. All right, cool. I'm going to play the didn't burn angle card. pulling out of your database.
But he's absolutely right, though. I mean, I can see where, you know, if somebody's that savvy or that quick enough to realize it that fast, that, yeah, he is sort of free-rolling to get the, you know, the outcome he wants. But, yeah, it's pretty tough to angle shoot that quickly in that scenario. But good point, though. Makes a good point.
Absolutely good point. Absolutely. And, Chris, we're not going to shoot any angles with you. We absolutely are giving you a free download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games. And it comes from element26.net. That's element26.net, where you go there, use code AU15, and you'll save some cash. And Chris, email us your address to podcast@aniupmagazine.com. We'll get that lovely swag out to you without angle of shooting.
And if there's anything that I know about, it's saving cash.
Yes, that is true.
I will go to great lengths to save money for whatever it is I'm trying to save.
Maybe we need to add some of those square, rough down sandpaper things.
Yeah, I'll autograph those for charity.
Yeah, I'm not touching those. Those are going to be all you, man. I didn't qualify to sign those.
Seriously, if somebody wants me to sign one and send it off to them for some cash, all you got to do is cover shipping and whatever's left over, we'll get the charity, man. So, hey, I'll sign a piece of sandpaper for charity. Absolutely.
And remember, call our hotline at 813-448-1120, and you too can get some swag.
All right. Well, now let's move to our mailbag. I love this guy's name. Jeremy Ronzio.
Yeah, it sounds like a Muppet, doesn't it?
At first, I was thinking of, like, Italian pasta. I don't know.
No, but, it's more like a Muppet. And I mean that in a positive manner. I love the Muppets.
Yeah, the Ronzio. That's a cool name.
Yeah, I mean, there were no Muppets named Long or Scott. But you can totally see, oh, man, that Ronzio, did you see him last week on Pigs in Space? He's totally cool.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, he sent in an email with a very good question, and then a couple weeks later sent another one with yet another good question. So, you know, one swag per person, right? But that doesn't mean that we can't put both questions on there.
Right.
So, let's see. Do you want to read the first one or the second one? The first.
I'll read the first one. I play a lot of tournaments and do very well. My problem is when I play ring games. What can I do to increase my skill at ring games without bringing down my tournament game?
Yeah, we've kind of covered this in the past, I think.
Yeah, we have.
I think. But the advice I give, and we gave in our Poker 101 courses, is that you have to remember that cash games are different than tournaments. And the biggest thing is, in cash games, you can reach into your pocket and bring more money out after the hand, of course. Not in the middle of the hand, unless you're angle shooting. After the hand. So there's less, depending on who you are, there's less risk involved. If you're in a freeze-out tournament, once you're out of chips, you are out of the tournament. You are dead, no matter how rich you are. So, you know, we make this point of, you know, Bill Gates or Donald Trump or whoever you want to pick. You know, in a cash game, they could go crazy all they want. Because if they go bust, they just, you know, take out another mortgage on the yacht, put more money on the table. Doesn't matter to them.
Right.
But in a free roll, we're all the same. You know, when they lose their chips, they're gone just like you are. So people play a little, I don't know if tighter is the right word, but a little more cautiously in a tournament than they do in a cash game. So knowing that information is how you should probably approach ring games.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing, too, is, you know, you should be more willing to take chances in ring games as well.
Yes.
Because, like you said, you can go back into your pocket. And you're also trying to win real money there. You're trying to get people's full stacks. And so you might be more willing to play cards that you wouldn't play in a tournament because no one would ever put you on that kind of hand or whatever. So, yeah, so knowing that they can reach into their pocket means they might be looser, too. You know, and so you have to adjust accordingly. If they're going to be loose, then you need to know how to play that player, you know, whether it means to tighten up yourself or open up the ranges that they're going to be playing, range of hands, and play accordingly. So, yeah, I love ring games. You know, I mean, I tend to get sucked out a lot on ring games and lose a lot of money, but I still wouldn't trade it in for tournaments. I like tournaments, but you can see how frustrated I was last week when we played in the charity one. I played for so long and didn't get anything out of it. I just felt like 10 hours at a cash game table. You know, I'd either have to sign over my house or I'd buy a house. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. But that's the best part. All right, so what's part two?
All right, part two. He says, I heard you guys mention fold equity on a recent podcast. Can you please explain this in greater detail and how it affects strategy?
Okay. You always put this on me, like M's and, you know. But a fold equity.
Hey, I give you an opportunity to ask the first question.
I know. But then you said. I took the shot. You were passive aggressive. Why don't you read the first question? I heard you. Maybe you should read the first you said. I'll play it back for you if you want.
I can take an early stab at fold equity. All right, it's a much more complicated scenario than we'll explain here on the podcast.
Yeah,
I think safe to say, correct?
Yeah.
But in general, I think fold equity. What you're looking at is the fact. It's part of the equation of when to bet, knowing that there's a possibility that. Your opponent will fold and therefore you win versus also them calling and then having to have showdown value.
Yeah. I mean, it's in other words, do you have enough chips where you can fold if someone puts pressure on you and vice versa? Do they have too few of chips where if you put pressure on them, they can't fold and then you act accordingly? So in other words, you don't want to try to make a move against somebody, if you have a ton of chips and they have almost no chips and they have some chips already committed to the pot, you don't want to make some sort of big, elaborate play to try to get this guy to fold when he's already pot committed. He has no fold equity. He has to call.
Right. Cannot push him off the hand.
Right. You can't push him off the hand and vice versa. They can't push you off the hand because you know you're shoving with any cards better than Queen 7 or whatever. And, you know, if you have 10,000, if you have 500 chips and they have 10,000, you don't have any fold equity. You know, because you have to pretty much play that hand no matter what the two cards are. So that's what it basically means. And then how it impacts strategy is, you know, you play these people accordingly. If you know this guy next to you isn't going to fold for no matter what the bet is because he has no chips and he has to put them in, then you're not going to want to go in there with deuce 7.
Right.
But conversely, if you think you can bluff somebody off a hand because they have enough chips to fold, then you do that too. So that's how it impacts your strategy.
Absolutely. Well done.
I think we did all right.
Much better than we do with pot odds.
It's one of those things that you just understand. It's like you can't tell somebody how to breathe. You just breathe.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right? You don't say...
Trust me, my wife tries to tell me to breathe, how to breathe every night. Can you please blow your nose? You're killing me.
I can feel for that, by the way.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure
I can relate.
All right, Jeremy, thank you for sending both of your mailbags. Unfortunately, not two swags or double swag. You're going to get plain old single swag. But hey, you're getting swag. $10 staking package from getastake.com where you can try out your fold equity there. And I keep running well in your tournaments. And, you know, just forget about those ring games. Who cares about ring games?
Hey.
Hey, that's one way to avoid having problems in ring games, right? Just not play them. It's also great advice for free rolls. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
This is Columbo from PokerWannabe.blogspot.com, and this is another one-minute mystery, the case of the jackhammers. It's early in a 100-person field of a very tough MTT.
What a way to start the day.
We've played only two hands to this point. In the first hand, I flopped a flush draw and picked up a gut shot on the turn with an over and decided to lead out, thinking that on a dangerous board that would give me an option of bluffing the river. My opponent read me well, came over the top, and shut down the hand, and I was forced to let it go. Hand two, I raise with jack-jack, the flop is queen high, and I call three small but consecutive bets to see a queen 10.
Best to avoid the fireworks, sir.
This third hand, I get jack-jack again, I raise again, and I get a caller. But this time the flop is 10 high, 10-7-3 rainbow. I bet the pot in order to protect my hand, and quite frankly I need the chips, and I get check-raised. I have 1,000 chips left, which is one-third of my starting stack size, and although the blinds are still low, this seems quite a pickle.
Just one more thing.
Before you answer, think about this. This tournament only pays the top two places. So, you gonna let this go?
All right, first of all, again, Columbo is on an amazing run with names here. Case of the jackhammers. Even if you're not jacks in your hand, which he had here, jackhammer is just a great word. You know, it's, kind of, it's like a nickname word. You're like, you're a hope in high school somebody calls you the jackhammer.
Yeah.
And not all the things that they used to call me. All right, but here's the thing. One, I've got to ask. I still don't get a good answer on this. What compels people to enter a 100-player tournament that only pays the top two spots?
Huh.
You know, Chris?
Yeah.
Can you help me out here?
I don't know.
I mean, I guess I get it. You know, there's a lot of money. It's top heavy. But, you know, to me, it's akin to the poker lottery ticket. This and bad beats.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much luck involved to get that top prize. I just don't get it. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah, we're in this situation, so let's make the best of it.
We can't lobby the tournament to pay 10 spots instead of 2. So, but here's the thing. If you're going to enter a tournament like this, Chris, I think you have to understand that your strategy is different than in a tournament where they pay down 10% or 15% or even 5%.
Right.
All right? And I think... And I've spent a lot of time playing these, so I'm not an expert on the strategy, but I think a layman would look at it and say, you got to chip up, and you got to be pretty aggressive.
Yep.
You can't, not that you want to sit around and try to eke into the cash in any tournament, but you have a little more flexibility. You can be a little more patient when you have a deeper payout structure. Right. Here, I want to get my money in when I've got a decent hand and chip up. And if not, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to play a real tournament. Not one of these carnival game tournaments. And I also got to think that smart opponents are going to do the same thing. And since Colombo said that there's a lot of very smart players in this, so I got to think our opponent here is smart. So since he or she didn't re-raise this pre-flop, I could be wrong, but I'm going to eliminate ace-ace, king-king, queen-queen. I just don't think you get tricky with those hands in this format. Because it's probably a very aggressive format. So the only thing that's beating us now, I think, is a set. But most likely here, I think we're looking at a bare 10. You know, okay. Ace 10 or something like that. And that guy knows, you know, hey, this guy made a raise. He has ace king. He missed the flop. I got a 10. I'm going to push, and I'm going to take it down right now, and I'm going to chip up. So here's the thing. If you're going to fold in this situation, I don't think you should be playing this tournament format. I think you're making a gross miscalculation if you're not able to be aggressive here. If you're going to fold, you know, quit playing these 100-player 2 spots. Play 100-player 10 spots, and you're fine. So, boom, I'm calling, shoving whatever we have left. Everything I have is going in here, including the Antiope Home Game original table.
Well, let me take a minute from sanding my chips to tell you that I totally agree with you. I think you said it best. I'm sorry, but I do come up with a different hand than you, though.
Okay. All right.
But it's true. If you're playing one, you know, for 1 in 50 spots, I mean, you got to get a lot of chips and you got to get a lot early because you're not getting anything for third. It's the same thing with the, of course, the better odds. But you know, poker after dark, those guys are playing for one spot only. They're not playing, you know. You know, long hands, and no, they're getting it in, hoping to double up soon or go home. So
I think the same thing for like WSOP satellites here in Florida and probably other brick and mortar rooms, you know.
Yeah.
You get buy-ins where like, you know, 1 in 70 get the prize package, you know.
Yeah. So
you know, you're really gonna sit around for 4 hours and get second. No, you know.
I think that this player has something like 8-9 or 9-9.
Okay.
They may have a 10, like you said, they may have the Cosenza like an idiot and play ace 10, but I think it feels like a drawing hand or a middle pair that's not on the board. So that's why I said 8-9 or 9-9.
But you're not worried about being behind.
No, I don't think we're behind here. I think we're ahead, and I definitely call in a heartbeat. So
excellent. How often are your heartbeats?
Pretty damn fast when I'm talking to you because you always tick me off when my heart starts racing.
So heartbeat does not have the same effect when I say it, you know. All right, well, we went to our forum at antiupmagazine.com/forum. It was almost unanimous in calling as well, Chris, so I think a lot of people think that this is, unfortunately, a no-brainer.
Okay, well, let's see if it actually is a no-brainer.
Welcome back. How simple of a decision was this for you?
I can't imagine it could be that easy.
What makes this hand interesting is its context. When you're running bad, you're more likely to call this bet. And when you're playing at the top of your game, I think you're more likely to fold, knowing that 1,000 chips this early still gives you a good amount of play. And did the mention of the top two only affect your decision process? Probably should. I remember one time getting all my chips in with Ace-King and Lee Watkinson sort of staring at me like I was crazy. And yet, at the same time, that was a similar situation, where it only played two places. And then later on, he looks at me and says, you know what? Maybe I would have got my chips in there. I'll level with you. I don't remember the hand my opponent had. Just that I made the call, saw the result, and went home. But there is a valuable lesson here. When you remove all the noisy context from the hand, it's a simple story. Either I need to give him credit for a big hand, or I think he's trying to put me on Ace-King and he's forcing me to fold. If this is a normal tournament, I tend towards folding here. But since it was top two only, I called. And in either selection, I think afterwards I end up kicking myself.
Did I make a good call here?
Until next time, this is Columbo from PokerWannabe.blogspot.com reminding you that sometimes a hand is just a hand.
Remember, Sven, our friendly Poker Stars Porsche dealer? Sven's still very excited.
Yeah!
He already knows that Poker Stars players together earn enough VIP points to redeem 5 Porsches every day. What's made him a little more excited is the fact that 5 of our Poker Stars players have already claimed these lovely pieces of German engineering. Keep Sven happy. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP to find out why our rewards program seems to have left all the other schemes, well, stuck in neutral. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
On Tuesday, enforcement of the oft-delayed Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act is due to finally go into effect, potentially affecting anyone who plays online poker. Today, we welcome back a guest who is on the forefront of the issue to let us know what this means for poker players across the United States. John Pappas is Executive Director of the Poker Players Alliance, a grassroots organization that has been the biggest advocate for online poker players in the United States. John, we know this is a busy week for you. We thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be on the program. Thanks for having me.
Okay, John, let's get right to it. Where do we stand on the UIGEA, and is there any prospects for another delay or at least a carve-out for online poker here before Tuesday?
Well, we're not giving up hope on that, but it is becoming less likely that a carve-out or delay will be granted. As you may know, the PPA was successful in getting a delay of the UIGEA back in November of 2009, and we delayed it 6 months, and the hope was that there would be some legislative progress to warrant a further delay. That did not come to pass. So about a month ago, the PPA filed another petition, not for delay, but to exempt peer-to-peer games from the final enforcement of the UIGEA, and we're still waiting to see if that will be granted. Again, we think it was a long shot request. We believe that Treasury and Fed kind of want to put this issue to bed. And you know, I think the PPA is recognizing that, you know, we've done a lot that we could do on this issue. If you recall, the bill was signed into law in 2006, October, and here we are, you know, nearly 4 years later, and we're just now finally seeing the law enacted. So I think we've done, you know, not to pat ourselves on the back, a lot of work to make sure that this law doesn't come to fruition and give everyone the opportunity to get prepared for this eventual date, and I think we've done that.
Well, it's probably impossible to know exactly what the UIGEA is going to mean in practice, but what's your gut telling you on what changes, if any, online poker players are going to see come Tuesday?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, in my conversations with folks, many believe that the UIGEA isn't going to change much. All of the negative impact of the UIGEA has likely already been felt by poker players over the last several years, because many of the banks and credit cards have voluntarily been subjecting themselves to the enforcement before the law became actually final, which will be on June 1st. So I think a lot of the headaches may have already been experienced, and June 1st may end up being kind of a bump in the road rather than a catastrophic event, as some have predicted.
Okay, now just to clarify, since we know it's probably on most of our listeners' minds, there isn't any reason for our players to worry about prosecution.
No, no.
Or any of that?
Yeah, no. The UIGEA coming into effect on June 1st does not, and I'll repeat this, does not make playing online poker for the player an illegal or unlawful activity. You know, there is this gray area for the processing of the payment. Should a bank process a payment for an internet poker transaction? And what you're going to see is that many of the online poker sites have already have what they call well-reasoned legal opinions that they're providing to banks that say, hey, we offer a skill-based peer-to-peer game online that should not be considered unlawful under any other state or federal law. Therefore, our payments should be processed as normal. And some banks will accept that and some banks will not. And like I said, I think there will always be a responsible pathway for people to deposit money onto online poker sites. And another, I think, important point for the players is that June 1st, whatever hiccups may be caused from that, it should not cause any disruptions in payouts. The law itself specifically says that it will not, it is not intended to block payouts from sites to players, but rather deposits from players to sites, to unlawful internet gambling sites. And again, you know, we argue that poker is an unlawful internet gambling, and I think we've got the well-reasoned legal opinions to back that up. And you know, we'll really see what happens on, you know, come June 2nd and June 3rd and August 2nd and August 3rd, and see how this all kind of unfolds. You know, one of the silver linings in all of this may be, as if there isn't, you know, substantial disruption, and which I don't believe that there will be, it might kind of wake up some of the lawmakers who believe that this is going to be the law that stops internet gaming, and recognize that maybe this idea that they're going to prohibit the activity through, you know, a draconian law like this isn't going to work. And really the alternative, which is what we've been advocating all along, is to license and regulate it in a responsible fashion.
Now, you mentioned some banks will probably be a little more aggressive at this than others. I mean, all of them, I think, are in agreement that it's going to be very difficult to identify what's an illegal transaction and what's not. So based on that, what is your gut on the possibility? How serious would the government be in prosecuting banks for transactions that they think are illegal?
Well, it's a good question. The interesting thing in the law is that banks have been given what they call overblock protection, so that if they overblock, meaning if they block a perfectly legal, should be legal transaction, and you interpret that for what it may be, is that a you know, someone who's playing a chess tournament online, or someone who's playing depositing money to play fantasy sports, those things which should have been exempted from the law. If they block those transactions, the player, the website, no one has recourse. The bank is completely immune from that. It's only when they underblock that they have immunity, that they are subject to any kind of penalties. And even in the final rule, though, I think a lot of those penalties were really kind of, for lack of a term, emasculated. And the banks, I don't think, have a whole lot of risk, at least criminal risk or civil risk, by processing payments. So we'll see what will happen. But I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there, you know, if there is an attempt to, you know, for the feds to look, place a little more scrutiny on the banks. But again, I think they're pretty much covered under the law, that they're not going to feel a whole lot of legal pain from this.
Well, recently an executive who was involved in online gaming payments pleaded guilty to charges of violating the Wire Act. How concerned is the PPA that we now have someone who's pleaded guilty to the act, which is a law that many of us argued isn't even applicable to online gaming?
Well, it's arguable whether it's applicable to online gaming. You know, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the Wire Act does apply to sports betting. And in as much that this gentleman was involved in processing payments for Sportsbook, then perhaps the Wire Act does apply. We would vociferously argue that it does not apply to peer-to-peer transactions like poker. And even the court, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, also upheld that by saying that it simply applies to sports betting transactions, not to poker and casino-style games. So I believe that's probably why that guilty plea was struck, because there was indeed sports betting transactions being processed, as well as casino and poker. But, you know, as far as we know, a Wire Act argument for pure poker transactions has never been prosecuted, and you know, if it does, hopefully the PPA will be in a position to defend that case.
And John, one of the reasons that online gaming opponents use is that gaming, whether it's casino gaming or sports betting or poker, creates these societal ills like higher divorce rates or bankruptcies. But virtually every state now has a lottery where gamblers are much more at risk of those ills from playing poker. How does the PPA respond to lawmakers who play that card, that use that reasoning?
Well, it's fear-mongering, really. You know, there are a lot of activities that adults engage in that can provide, you know, problems at home and problems in the community, and we aren't seeking to outlaw those issues. And in reality, gambling addiction and the problems related to gambling are few and far between. I mean, I think the percentages are somewhere about 1-3% of Americans are identified as problem or pathological gamblers. That is a very small percentage of adults, and the idea that we're going to prevent 95-98% of Americans from enjoying an activity because a few have a problem with it doesn't seem like a very sensible public policy. What we ought to be doing is focusing our energies on how do we help those few Americans that do have a problem. How do we make sure that there is a mechanism in place so that they aren't addicted to gaming, or they aren't doing things that are detrimental to themselves or their families? And then allow for a safe and regulated marketplace for the responsible adults who want to enjoy this as whether a form of recreation or a profession. You know, being a professional poker player is no longer kind of profession. There are professional poker players who play professionally online and play professionally in Vegas, and it's becoming a pretty accepted avocation. And the idea that we're going to prevent people from doing that because a few others might have a problem seems a little hypocritical, but it also seems like a bad public policy decision. So, you know, in the end, progress is always going to win here. And we believe that, you know, we're on kind of the tipping point of where internet poker is going to be licensed and regulated. And those who have this view that it is somehow immoral or begets all sorts of social ills, that viewpoint is really going to the wayside. And particularly because you look at it, 48 out of the 50 states have some sort of gaming already that is regulated and controlled by the state and taxed by the state. And that is, you know, everything from pari-mutuel horse racing to lotteries to casino-style gaming to card rooms. You know, they're pretty much part of the fabric of America today, and I think the internet game is just a natural evolution of this.
Oh, well, speaking of regulation, then, the House Ways and Means Committee held a hearing on possibly regulating online gaming this month. How well do you think that hearing went, and is Congressman Barney Frank's bill still on track to be marked up in July?
Everything seems to be on track for a July markup, which Mr. Frank announced at the hearing in the Ways and Means Committee last week. I thought the Ways and Means Committee hearing actually went very well. There was a good dialogue about the merits of internet gaming that I think we haven't seen in some of the other committees where the issue is somewhat demagogued. It was refreshing to see the Ways and Means Committee, both Republicans and Democrats, take it very seriously and look at the merits of the issue than rather than kind of demagoguing it. So that was good to see. We also saw, one member in particular, Bob Goodlatte, who was there to kind of serve as the antagonist against internet gaming. And you really saw him face some very difficult questioning from his colleagues, both Republican and Democrat, who really questioned his opposition. Was it really based on sound policy, or was it based on kind of moral religious reasons? And I think it came out that, you know, his opposition was morally based, not necessarily public policy based. And I think lawmakers recognize that this isn't something that they're going to have to make a moral decision about, but what is the best, you know, federal policy for internet gaming.
Now, we've all watched Schoolhouse Rock, but I don't think Schoolhouse Rock has mentioned marked up before. Can you explain what marked up means to our listeners?
Sure. It means that it'll be amended and voted on in the committee. It's part of the process. The bill gets introduced, and then it usually goes to a hearing in the committee in which it was introduced. And then after a hearing, they generally hold what they call a markup. And the markup allows for all the members of the committee to provide amendments to the bill that would, you know, change it in ways that they would like to see it changed. And then at the end of the markup, they will vote on the bill as amended. And then that bill would be the bill that moves forward to either the next committee or moves forward to the House floor. And that is what's going to happen in Chairman Frank's Financial Services Committee in July, is that there will be a markup of the bill. And you'll see all sorts of different amendments try to be added to the bill that either are going to, in our view, strengthen it or weaken it. We'll have to look at each of those amendments and see which ones we support and which ones we oppose. And hopefully in the end, the product that comes out of the committee is a bill that's even better than what was introduced.
So what's the status of other pending federal legislation?
As you know, there is a bill on the Senate side that looks simply at licensing and regulating internet poker and other peer-to-peer games. That's introduced by Senator Bob Menendez. And there's been a lot of speculation that Harry Reid, the majority leader, who also hails from Nevada, a very pro-gaming state, is examining and may introduce legislation of his own that I think would track closer to Senator Menendez's bill than it would Chairman Frank's bill. But that's, you know, that's yet to be seen. The process and the focus has really been on the House side, and we're going to continue to make sure that we educate as many House members on this issue as possible. We need to win the hearts and minds of all the lawmakers that this is in fact an activity that's going on, whether they like it or not, and what is really the responsible government approach to it. And I think on a day-by-day basis, we're actually making a lot of progress to that front.
Now, John, you've been active down here in Florida recently, and I'm sure you know what we know, that we've watched poker legislation kind of slog through the process down here as competing stakeholders looked out for their own interests rather than coming together for a common goal. Are we starting to see some of that on the national level now, as some big U.S. companies seem to be looking for a way to get online gaming legalized, but only for companies that are based in the United States now?
Well, that, unfortunately, we are seeing a little bit of that, and it's what is being lost on those who want to serve a protectionist model or have a protectionist model that only benefits a few is that what they're forgetting is that we're talking about the internet here. And the internet does not work well in a monopoly. The internet, as by its nature, is an open source, an open environment. And any attempts to kind of limit competition over the internet, I think it's going to be the demise of those who try to enforce these monopolies. States that want to do it, Florida, for instance, was looking at an intrastate internet poker bill that would have provided only one hub provider of internet poker, meaning that there would really be only one website that people would be able to go on and play in Florida. That's just a non-starter for the consumer. Nothing good comes out of a single provider of any service. We saw that in cable. We've seen that in all sorts of industries. And we think competition is gonna breed the best consumer experience. So, you know, the PPA is going to stand in front of anyone's legislative proposal that tries to limit poker, tries to limit it to one operator.
You know, many players had hoped that the action on the UIGEA might slow down under the Obama administration. Is the PPA surprised that it appears that it hasn't slowed down?
You know, I wouldn't say surprised. I just don't think that this is something that's really been on the top of the president's agenda. You know, whether it is to stop this law or whether to make this law fully enforced. You know, we did see this administration provide a six-month reprieve of the law, which, you know, I don't think that should be lost on anyone. That is a really strong signal from the president and from the agencies that they view flaws here. Now, the fact that it's going to be finalized under their watch, I don't think it means that they are in one way pro or anti-internet gaming. I just think it just means that, you know, this law is going to go into effect, and I think we're continuing to build momentum behind any sort of legislation that will mute it through licensing and regulation. So, you know, I don't put the Obama administration in one camp or the other. I think there's still an opportunity to get them to come out on this issue, but really Congress is going to have to act first. And once Congress acts in a real substantive way, then I think you'll see the Obama administration come out, I believe, in support of licensed and regulated internet poker.
Okay.
Well, John, we definitely appreciate you joining us. We know you're busy and got to get going. Before you leave, though, do you want to remind our listeners of the PPA's website and also fill them in on anything else that's going on that you might want to share with them?
Sure. The PPA website is theppa.org. You can go there and you can use any of our tools to send letters to Congress. We have video updates regularly on things that are going on in Washington and throughout the country. The PPA is involved in a number of state legislative activities, including right there in Florida. And other states in the South, like South Carolina, were engaged in a very big legal debate there on skill versus chance. You know, one interesting thing that we're doing this week is we're holding a big rally in Washington State, where we expect hopefully several hundred poker players to show up in support of a Supreme Court case that the PPA is supporting, that would challenge the constitutionality of a law that they have there that, believe it or not, makes poker, playing online poker and other wagers over the internet in the state of Washington, a Class C felony. You could be essentially charged with a maximum 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine, the same charges that are found for someone who is a child pornographer or a heroin possession, playing a 5-cent, 10-cent game online in Washington State. It's a ridiculous law. We have a number of our members who are really up in arms about it, and they're going to be joining us, and professional poker player Phil Gordon and our chairman, Senator Alphonse D'Amato, on the steps of the courthouse this Thursday opposing that bill. These are just some of the things that the PPA does to kind of bring the poker community together and let them speak with one voice in opposition to laws that restrict our rights. And, you know, we will engage in this kind of activity anywhere in the country where we feel that the rights of poker players are being limited.
Well, thank you again, John. We appreciate it. Keep up the great work at the PPA, and we'll check in with you a little bit later.
Sounds good, guys. Thank you so much, and love to be on the program. Have me on anytime you like.
Hi, this is Shannon Elizabeth, and you are listening to the Anti-F PokerCast.
Chris, it's been a long time coming, but we welcome back our favorite father, Lee Childs.
What's
How's
happening,
the little
guys?
One doing, Lee?
Oh, he's doing great.
Good, good. Is he doing well with the disappointment not being named Scott?
Yeah, you know, I actually didn't tell you. We actually did name him Chris. We've changed it from Braden to Chris, but I didn't want to let you know. So now I guess it's, you know, we've been hiding it too long. So
you're allowed to do that within the first 2 years. So, I mean, you know, that's pretty normal. So, you know, the check's in the mail.
Wow.
Yep.
Wow, you're really trying hard to mess this kid up. All right, well, one thing we know you never mess up is a hand of the week, so we're happy to have your expert advice back on the show, and let's get right into it. All right, this is a hand that is on the 50-50 tournament on an online poker site not affiliated with Anti-Up, and it comes to us from a guy named Thomas Turley, is it? Turley, yes. I haven't heard of this guy. Have you, Lee?
Yeah, I do. I kind of know his reputation. I'm just going to go out on the limb and say that he played the hand horribly wrong, and we can probably go on to the next hand.
Of course, we joke. Tom has been a long-time listener and a good friend, Lee, and sent this hand in. Didn't realize that Lee would be analyzing it, but, you know, got to have Lee analyze Tom Turley's hand, don't we, Chris?
Yeah, you know, Tom's daughter has called me on numerous occasions by
she
accident
too. Yes.
Playing with his phone, so this is a little payback, I think.
All right, he says they were just about over an hour and 45 minutes in the tournament, gets moved to a new table, let's see, he has 21-31 in chips. We look around the table, and there's one person a little less than him. Chip leader is a little less than 10,000. All right, and it says it's the third hand that he saw. Blinds are at 40-80. Of course, this is No Limit Texas Hold'em. I guess I should have mentioned that. And it's folded all the way around to one off the button. And this person, Svetlana Gromenkova.
Ah.
2008 Ladies Event winner at the World Series of Poker. She's got a bracelet. And she pumps it to 222, which is 2.77 times the big blind. Come on, that was worth a little more chuckle. No?
I'm going to let you know right now, I'm just going to be in the background today until Lee pipes up and commits himself to something. So,
yeah. Well, first of all, I have to say, you didn't have to say that it was a no-limit hold'em hand. You've got me on here. analyze it.
That is
so
true.
Everybody already knew that. Yeah, 222, Svetlana, bracelet winner. And on the button, you have absolutely no information about her hand at this point. She's got over twice the stack that Tom does at this point. 47-65. He's got 21-31. I assume that's after posting the big blind. Nothing really to be gained other than the fact that she raised. She's a pretty aggressive player. Played with her quite a bit, and she's pretty solid. So. She's raised from the button, so let's see what we got.
All right, so Tom's in the small blind with 9 of spades, 8 of spades, those all-powerful suited connectors that are 4 times more powerful than pocket aces.
Agreed. If you know how to play them. Well, most people don't know how to play aces either, so, you know, it doesn't really matter.
All right, so what do you do with a suited connector out of position against an aggressive player that you know?
Well, you know, the big thing with these is they are powerful hands, especially if you think the person has a really strong hand. So, you know, if she's raised under the gun, I'd rather be playing them in position. I'd rather be playing anything in position. But, you know, the earlier position she raises, the more I think she's, you know, got a big hand that if – it just gives me better implied odds. If I am able to hit my hand You know, maybe she's got an ace king type of hand, and it comes ace 9 8, where I flop two pair, and she tries to protect her hand, is willing to commit a lot of chips, or maybe she has an overpair to the board, something like that. So when somebody raises from late position, first of all, I'm not giving her credit for a big hand. She may happen to have a big hand here, but you know, obviously, the later position she is, the more you can say that her range is much wider. So if I do hit my hand, I don't expect to have as many, as much implied odds in this spot, because her range is just so big. So she's not as likely to have something she really feels so excited about. You know, people look at aces or kings and think, oh boy, I'm going to double. And, you know, and so when somebody comes in from early position, you can kind of assign them that tighter range of a big hand. The second thing is, when you're playing them, besides wanting to play them in position, you really don't want to call more than about 5% of the effective stack size, which will be the smaller of the two stack sizes. So in this case, with him having about 2,000, 2,100, you know, he's really looking to be able to see a flop for only about 100 more, maybe 105, 110. It's stretching it a little bit, because it's, I guess, going to be about 140 more. He's in the big blind, right?
Small blind.
No, small blind. Okay, yeah. So it's even more. So it's
182
more. So with 21, he's putting in, you know, it's getting close to 10% of his stack out of position against an aggressive player. So it's not really a good spot. I would fold. Because I'm looking, like, the other things that he's saying, you know, if he, you know, he thinks that if he calls, you know, he could hit a nice flop, could get paid off. What I like to tell people is that's really a lot of hoping there. Like, those things are true. You know, those things are definitely true, that you can potentially hit a flop. They're easy to play because you're not likely to get that attached to it. You know, even a 9 or 8 high board, if somebody's given you a lot of resistance, you don't typically feel as attached to it, or you shouldn't. And, you know, if it hits you, it usually doesn't hit them. But in this case, because she's a later position raiser, I don't really want to go above that 5% rule when she's raising from late position with a wide range of hands, and I'm going to be out of position, because I just don't think the implied odds are there. Which, you know, you really want those 20-to-1 implied odds, which is why we use that 5% rule. And so all the conditions that we really want to play a suited connector are not there. Obviously, Tom's not going to fold here. We wouldn't have a hand of the week. But, you know, those are just the things to factor in. Those are just, you know, kind of the rules that I like to play by. I will sometimes stretch that 5% if, say, we're extremely deep stacked. So even if I miss pre-flop, it's not really going to hurt me that much. And also if I'm on the button and the raise comes from under the gun, because now I have the best position and it's somebody raising from the position that should have, you know, representing the strongest types of hands. So that's really where I'd want to stretch it if I'm going to at all. Right on.
See, this is the difference between Chris and I, Lee. I am soaking up your vast knowledge like a sponge. And, Chris, all you are to Chris is a cheap joke.
And Chris is re-raising under-the-gun raises with Ace-10 and going broke and getting mad about how bad he runs.
I'm sorry. I'm Chris Cosenza. Oh, I'm sorry. Is that the end of the show?
Oh, man.
Holy cow. It was like 12 minutes there. We haven't even seen a flop yet. If I had to think that long, no wonder why they call clocks on me. You know, if I was thinking that long, good God.
This is where you should really just end it. It doesn't even matter. It should be a fold right here, but that's all of the thought process that goes into it, and then you fold and go on to the next hand.
All right, Tom, learn from that. We'll see you next week.
But keep wearing my patch at the series, buddy. I appreciate it.
All right, well, Tom does call here, as Lee said. It would not be a very exciting hand if he didn't. And the big blind gets out of the way, so we're heads up to a flop of four of spades, ace of clubs, five of diamonds,
not at all what we were hoping to see, Lee, is it?
Nope.
All right, so I'm assuming you're going to check as Mr. Turley did.
Yep. Is that better, Chris?
Yeah, I'm lost on his hand, so yeah, I agree with you completely.
How are you lost?
I'm working here while you're talking. I don't know.
Oh! All right, so we check, and our villain decides to check behind.
Okay.
The turn brings the six of spades. So our board now is four of spades, ace of clubs, five of diamonds, six of spades. Still no help to us. But do we read something into that check on the flop?
It's a pretty dry board, really. You know, it's a rainbow board. It does have the ace. I would expect her to continuation bet a lot of the time. So I think when she doesn't bet, she may have an ace, and she's trying to, you know, let Tom catch up. That's probably the thought process there. If I was in her position, I'm just firing a continuation bet whether I hit or not. It's not a draw heavy board, so I wouldn't expect, you know, it's not the type where Tom's probably going to check raise with air. So I don't know why she doesn't bet if she does have an ace, other than to maybe give him a chance to catch up, which may not come back to bite her.
Okay. Well, we did not catch up, but we do have straight and flush draws.
Yep.
So what do you like to do here?
I'm usually going to just go ahead and check here. It'd be okay to bet, and if I'm going to bet, it's going to, you know, be half to two thirds of the pot. But it's, you know, a semi bluff type of bet is certainly not out of line. There's three to the straight. He's called out of the small blind. He could just happen to take it down right there. If she does happen to have some piece of it and he were to hit his draw, then, you know, maybe he'll get paid off. So I'm really okay with a check or a bet. I think if it was on the flop and I flopped my gut shot with the flush draw, I might have led into the razor, because that's a really big draw for me, especially if it was open-ended one, one that I want to commit chips to, and I want to, you know, make them think. Like, normally, like, if you flop the draw, there'd be two spades there, right? So somebody may actually just get out of the way thinking it's not worth it that you're protecting your ace on that flush board. Mm-hmm. So they may fold hands that are better than yours. So I really don't have a problem with checking or betting in this spot, but, you know, check calling is certainly the safest one. But then if you hit your draw, are you going to be able to get paid off? So leading usually will help you get paid off if you happen to hit, but you just run the risk of being raised off of your draw as well.
Right. All right. Well, Tom decides to bet, but he only puts in a bet of 160.
Yeah. So a little blocking bet there. And you know, she may, if I had an ace and I were her, then I would raise in that spot, I think, to go ahead and try to protect it. But, I think if you're going to bet, I'd rather make a more convincing bet and bet around like 300 or something.
Okay. Well, he bets the 160, and our opponent takes her time and calls. Go to the river, which is the seven of hearts. So our final board, four of spades, ace of clubs, five of diamonds, six of spades, seven of hearts. We've hit our straight.
We got the stone cold nuts.
How is the best way to extract value from this hand now?
This is interesting because she could have been on a flush draw herself or picked up the flush draw, but I really think, I mean, it seems I see this a lot with, you know, flopping an ace, or maybe it's even like kings or queens or jacks. You know, it's, you know, it's either like a top pair weak kicker or it's second pair that's not on the board. I don't really expect her, you know, I mean, she raised for the button, so her range is pretty big. But it's really kind of strange that, that she just calls there. Maybe she's trying to play some pot control. You know, if this is one of those that if you think she will think you're bluffing. Like his small bet kind of looks like he's got a, you know, he's trying to put a blocking bet for his flush draw, which is, you know, exactly what he's got. He's got this draw and he's trying to control the pot from out of position, which is tough to do. So, by hitting, I mean, actually my, you know, my favorite kind of draw is a flush draw with a gut shot, because if the gut shot gets there and you play it just like a flush draw, people will try to call your bluff.
Right.
And, you know, and they say, aha, I know you got the busted flush, and you say you're right, and then you turn over nuts. So, you know, I mean, a pretty good sized bet, even a shove. If you think she's strong enough to call and that she'll think you're bluffing, then a shove would be fine here too, or just whatever you think she can call. So, I think just like anything, you know, a small bet might get her to raise as a, you know, but I would err towards, you know, like a three-quarter pot bet or even a shove at this point.
All right. So he does shove 1,749 units, and she calls.
Wow.
Chris is just not impressed.
I'm just trying to fit her on her hand here. I don't know what kind of hand it could be calling with, so.
Well, I mean, yeah, it does say something that she's calling 1749 here on the river.
Yeah.
Yeah, she has to have an eight to call.
Yeah, yeah.
Or she just thinks he's bluffing and she's got a set and she played it weird. And if she has an eight, I would think, well, wouldn't be the eight with the flush draw. It could be the, you know, if she had the ace, like, you know, I said, it could be a weak ace. It could be the ace eight. It could be like a, you know, like a 7-8, where she just calls on the turn. And now, you know, 7-8, same hand, obviously, could be a 9-8, anything with an eight. But I can't see her calling the shove unless she's got a set and thinks he's bluffing, or she has an eight in her hand.
All right, Scott, put us out of our misery.
All right. She mucks eight of hearts, ace of spades for the lower straight.
Yeah.
She did have the ace on the flop. Misplayed, in your opinion, Lee?
Yeah, it's pretty awful. I mean, she definitely should have made her continuation bet. I mean, it's just you don't want to mix that stuff up. You know, when you she hit with a, you know, a weakish hand, doesn't think he hits, she's going to let him catch up. Like, it's not like she's got. She didn't flop quads and she wants him to catch up, you know.
Yeah.
She flopped a very vulnerable hand. I mean, he could have, you know, pocket nines, and then the nine comes and she has no idea where she is. I mean, it's just too hard, you know, and she ends up losing a really big pot here, with a mediocre hand, and all she really needed to do was, you know, make a continuation bet. And, you know, and a lot of people get discouraged when they don't get paid off when they flop some kind of hand. And you know, and you can't really do that, because you want there, most of the time you don't want your bets to be called anyway. You're not going to hit to where you want to play a big pot. So if you raise and somebody calls, you make a continuation bet and they fold, that's fine. Because a lot of times you don't have anything that matches with the board. So if you're going to want that to happen, then you can't have them just call you when you've got the hands and not call you when you don't, you know, so. I think she should make her continuation bet. She would have won it right there, unless Tom went crazy on us. Tom's played in my home game, and he's kind of crazy a little bit. We had a few beers that night, I think. So he was pretty much playing in the dark for about an hour and a half or 2 hours, I think, but and doing well. it was a lot of fun. Anyway, I think she played it horribly, and I think Tom played it just fine.
Hey, does Tom win anything?
Yeah,
he's he's pretty regular, you know. Does he get anything?
Oh yeah, that. I thought you meant, does he win anything at poker?
No. I mean swag. Does he get swag?
Yeah,
today?
I know he wins the poker. I know he won his main event seat last year.
All right, Tom. We appreciate you sending the hand in, and we will send you a uncut sheet of J Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Ante Up.
Cool.
We do not have the lobster version though, Tom. Sorry, you'll have to settle for the. non-claw version of those J-Design cards playingcards.com.
Yeah, I think he should win another dinner with us, courtesy of his wife at the Palm in Vegas this summer. That's what
I think. I think we can arrange that swag. It would probably be up to her, though. But
sweet.
All right, Lee, great to have you back, and hopefully we'll have you back next week as well, too.
All right, thanks, guys.
All right, I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
And we will see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
Wow.
Still took almost an hour.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was a short show.
Good God, I still have a 20-minute Hand of the Week and a 20-minute John Pappas interview.